Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Melissa Walker, director of the Neuropediatric Mitochondrial Disorders Clinic at Mass General Hospital in Boston, will join us to discuss immune cell function in mitochondrial disease. My name is Stephanie Harry, and I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcast, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature in the bottom menu bar of your screen. If you're calling in via phone, please feel free to submit your questions to us by email at info@mitoaction.org, and we'll do our best to get through as many questions as possible at the end of today's presentation. Immune dysfunction is increasingly appreciated in mitochondrial disorders. Today, Dr. Walker will review the small number of known immune manifestations of specific primary mitochondrial disorders, as well as emerging studies on nonspecific immune dysfunction and mitochondrial disease more broadly. Dr. Walker is an assistant professor of neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, where she's the director of the Neuropediatric Mitochondrial Disorders Clinic and a translational investigator with a focus on mitochondrial disorders. Her research focuses on biomarker development for mitochondrial diseases. Dr. Walker, we are really, really excited to have you here today with us and to tackle this important and challenging topic. Thank you so much for all your hard work and all that you do for our mito community.
Thank you so much for the invitation and for that kind introduction. I will share screen. Okay, hello. Thank you, everyone. And thank you for the kind introduction, Stephanie Harry. As you heard, I'm Melissa Walker. I am a child neurologist at Mass General Hospital, where I run the Pediatric Mitochondrial Disorders Clinic. And I also spend 80% of my time, actually, doing basic science and translational research on mitochondrial disorder biomarkers with Fonzi Mutha, who is an investigator here at Mass General Hospital. So I always like to start every talk with some disclosures. Just so you all are aware, I am an author on a pending patent application regarding a technology that is actually not related to what I'm going to present today. I also get research funding from the NIH, both for mitochondrial disorder research, as well as being part of the Undiagnosed Disease Network. I've received honoraria from the American Academy of Neurology and research funding from private foundations, including Child Neurology Foundation and the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation. So what are we going to talk about today? As I've addended my title here to say, I want to have a very patient-centered talk today. I want to focus on the material that is most relevant to the patient experience, patient lives, and management. We will discuss, though I know this audience needs no introduction to mitochondria and primary mitochondrial disorders, we'll just start with that, get on the same page, and then talk about immune cells. What are they, and what roles do mitochondria play in them? Next, we will ask some questions. Specifically, do primary mitochondrial disorders put patients at higher risk of immune deficiency and or infection, broadly speaking? And specifically, since it is 2023, we'll ask that question with regard to COVID-19. And then we will discuss what are the current recommendations from the expert consensus that's available out there. We'll also ask, do patients have different responses to immunization? And then finally, we will ask whether there are higher risk of adverse events in patients with primary mitochondrial disorders with immunization, both for routine immunizations and for the COVID-19 immunization. And what do the experts think, so to speak? And then what do the real experts think? What do patients and their families think about these issues? So, starting with, what are mitochondria and primary mitochondrial disorders? Well, as you all are very well aware, mitochondria are double membrane-bound organelles that we have in almost all of the cells in our body. Interestingly, one exception is red blood cells. But the most famous thing that mitochondria do, perhaps, is to generate ATP, which is the energy currency of our cell, and they do that by oxidative phosphorylation with the electron transport chain. I'm trying to summarize that for you here in a cartoon. This is, of course, many different biochemical reactions occurring in tandem and depending on each other that ultimately result in the production of that ATP that our bodies use for energy, as well as divalent oxygen, and doing important things that we call redox reactions. So taking NADH and oxidizing it to NAD+. And that's important for many things that our cells and bodies need to do in other biochemical reactions. I'll also point out that the mitochondrial electron transport chain generates this membrane potential, this electrical charge separation that enables it to do oxidative phosphorylation, but also many other important biologic functions of mitochondria. And I apologize, I should have prefaced this by saying, I apologize if I'm telling you all things you already know. I am going to try to start at the kind of foundational level with everything I say to be the most accessible. So, famously, of course, mitochondria perform oxidative phosphorylation and make ATP. And I'm going to pause here for a moment to point out that in prior decades, this is how we diagnosed mitochondrial disorders, because this is what we knew that they did. We used biochemical reactions to see if patients or might have difficulty making ATP. And if they did, we said, okay, this is probably a mitochondrial disorder. But we only knew what we knew. And in ensuing years, we found out that that's not the only thing mitochondria do. They also do fatty acid oxidation, which is another way our body makes energy. I know many of you will be very familiar with that process. Also, one carbon metabolism, which to grossly oversimplify, is a series of metabolic reactions that take the vitamins that we eat in our daily diet or that you might be recommended to take as a patient and turn them into cofactors or things that are the enzymes and proteins in our cells and bodies need to perform the functions that keep us healthy. They also do something called nucleotide pool homeostasis, which is a fancy way of saying they keep balanced the number of building blocks for DNA and RNA that are present in mitochondria and in the cell probably more largely. They do something called iron sulfur cluster biogenesis. And this is something the field of metabolism is becoming increasingly aware of the importance of. So our bodies, as you probably know, need iron. And one of the reasons we need iron is to serve as a cofactor for many of these enzymes, a necessary part for many of these enzymes and reactions. But iron can be dangerous to cells if it's not handled correctly. And the mitochondria have this important task among the many important tasks that they do. And finally, second to last, cell cycle progression. So we are increasingly understanding as a scientific community how important mitochondria are in regulating when our cells divide and how long an individual cell lives. And finally, very relevant to this talk, mitochondria play critical roles in the immune system. And we are just now learning how deep those roles go. They interpret and receive signals from viruses when there are infections in cells. They are critical components of how immune cells talk to each other and how they fight infection. So, what are primary mitochondrial disorders? Primary mitochondrial disorders, as you know, are a group of heterogeneous, meaning diverse, multi-system, meaning affecting many organs in our bodies, disorders. And they can have very important clinical manifestations almost anywhere in the body. It's starting from the top, because I am a neurologist, they can affect our brains and produce symptoms like seizure or stroke or movement disorders, difficulty with balance. They can affect our hearing and lead to sensory neural hearing loss. They can affect our nerves, making it difficult to move our bodies or to sense touch or other sensations. They can affect our muscles, also producing fatigue or muscle weakness. But they can also impact the endocrine system and cause thyroid disease, diabetes. They can cause liver disease, heart disease, or lung disease, kidney disease, or difficulties with gastrointestinal motility, either too much or too little. They also can affect how the body stores energy, including changing the adipose tissue. Now, one of the many things that makes these disorders difficult to diagnose and to treat is that genetically, they can be caused by more than 300 different genes. And those genes, as you are probably aware, can be encoded either by our nuclear DNA, which we get half of from mom and half of from dad, or our mitochondrial DNA, which we inherit exclusively from our mothers. These disorders have, as I have said, marked phenotypic heterogeneity, by which I mean they can cause any number of symptoms with varying levels of severity that can be very different between even two siblings in the same family. And importantly, our understanding as a scientific community of how changes in genes that work inside the mitochondria make changes in the mitochondria or the cell, let alone the whole body, to produce liver disease or seizure, is still grossly incomplete. We still really don't understand how you get from point A to point B there. Probably for that reason, we also don't have biomarkers for mitochondrial disorders right now. No single reliable test. And what do I mean by that? So if, for example, my doctor is concerned that I might have diabetes, she can send a blood test that will tell her whether I have diabetes or not. But also, with that single blood test, she's able to track and see if my diabetes gets better if I take a medication or if it gets worse if I change my diet. But we don't have anything like that for mitochondrial disease, not in a reliable fashion right now. Excuse me. And that is a big reason, probably, why we also don't have FDA-approved treatments for mitochondrial disorders specifically. There is an important exception. Friedreich ataxia, as you probably know, just had omalazolone approved by the FDA within the past year, which is terrific, but we still have so far to go. So I've just told you that mitochondrial disorders can affect so many systems in the body. Interestingly, you probably don't think of immune cells or immune dysfunction as being classically part of a mitochondrial disorder. But if we say that there are mitochondria in those cells and that mitochondrial disorders can affect any system in the body, it would stand to reason that this might be a place where we should look. So let's talk about the immune system. When we think of the immune system, we typically think of two subsections. The first is called the innate immune system. And this is kind of our first line of defense against infection. And in this case, the immune response is not specific to the exact virus or the exact bacterium or bacteria that are being fought by the body. The cells that do this are called neutrophils, eosinophils, monocytes, dendritic or DC cells, and NK or natural killer cells. The second part of our immune system is something called the adaptive immune system. And this is the second line, if you will. This is the tailored or bespoke response to a specific infectious agent or pathogen. And in that case, our T cells and B cells actually recognize specific viruses or bacteria and fight them in a way that is specific to that virus or bacteria or fungus. Excuse me. And importantly, T cells or B cells are able to remember that specific infectious agent. And if we encounter it again, turn that program to fight that infection back on. It's the adaptive immune system, actually, that is being targeted when we get a vaccine. The vaccine is trying to teach our B cells and T cells how to fight a given infection and have them remember it in case we ever encounter it in real life. So I want to go cell by cell and tell you what each cell type does, and you'll see why in just a minute. And I will also tell you what scientific evidence we have as far as the functions of mitochondria within each of these cell types. So starting with that first line of defense, the most common cell type is the neutrophil. So neutrophils actually engulf pathogens to kill them. They will surround bacteria or surround fungi and engulf them and kill them to fight an infection. if we don't have enough neutrophils, something called neutropenia, we can have medical problems, specifically an increased rate of specific infection types. And because one mitochondrial disorder is commonly has low neutrophils, I've summarized data from one of the studies regarding that disorder, which is called Barth syndrome. So those patients have been observed to have infections of the skin or cellulitis, pneumonia or infections of the lung, septicemia, which is a blood infection, infectious bronchitis, and infectious diarrhea. And these can be, as you might imagine, hugely problematic for these patients. In neutrophils, basic science has taught us that mitochondria are necessary for the development of neutrophils. So if the mitochondria aren't working properly, our body can't make the neutrophils to fight the infection. And also to move within the body. So our bone marrow makes all of our immune cells and they are released into the blood and they circle around our body and they have to go to whatever organ is infected. And if the mitochondria aren't working properly in the neutrophils, there can be impairment of neutrophil movement. And actually that process by which neutrophils engulf bacteria and kill them is dependent on proper functioning of mitochondria. Next, we have the natural killer cells, and these attack and kill cells in our body that have been infected, either with viruses or other pathogens, and also tumor cells. If you don't have enough properly functioning natural killer cells, you might have an increased susceptibility to viruses, particularly viruses in the herpes family, such as cytomegalovirus, herpes virus 1 and 2, VZV, which causes chickenpox, and the mononucleosis virus. In natural killer cells, mitochondria are involved in switching between natural killer cell types and their different functions, as well as survival of the longest-lived natural killer cells, which fight infection for us. Moving on to monocytes. So monocytes are what we call these cells when they're circulating in the blood. But once they move into the tissues where they're going to fight infection, they actually transition into macrophages. And as macrophages, they kill fungal infections, mycobacteria, which are things like tuberculosis, and some bacterial species, such as Salmonella. In monocytes, we know, and in macrophages, that mitochondria are required for inflammatory responses, specifically something called inflammasome activation, which is a process by which macrophages produce infection-fighting enzymes and reactive species. They also are important for switching between macrophage types and functions. Finally, the last cell type in the innate immune system is the eosinophil, and these are a little bit of an outlier. We know that they're important for fighting parasitic infections, things like amoebas or worms, but they're also important in allergic responses. So if someone is having an allergic response to a food or an allergen, if they're having an asthma attack, they will often have increased levels of eosinophils in their blood. Interestingly, in eosinophils, mitochondria are important, we know, for the programmed cell death, but they are not important for making ATP, it seems. Moving on to the adaptive immune system, T cells are the majority of the adaptive immune system cellular components, and they have multiple functions. They coordinate the response, they talk between cells, they kill virus-infected cells, and they kill tumor cells. And importantly, they're able to, as I mentioned before, remember prior infections, if you will, and restart that immune response when that infection is encountered again. Deficiency in T cells is a very important medical problem and can lead to something called severe combined immune deficiency if B cells are also deficient. And that is a propensity to almost any type of infection. It can increase risk of viral infections, fungal infections, and something we call opportunistic infections. And when I say that, what I mean is that an individual would develop an infection from something that typically a bacteria or a virus that typically lives on or all around our bodies, but never causes us trouble because our T cells are usually able to keep that pathogen at bay. In T cells, there's actually been a lot of scientific study of mitochondria, and we know that they are required for our body's development of T cells and of the appropriate number of T cells and the appropriate diversity of T cell subtypes. It is important for the T cells to maturation process, and there are many steps to that to produce all the different types of T cells that appropriately fight infection but don't attack the body. It's important for the transition between different types of T cells. And it's important for something called T cell activation. And T cell activation is the process by which a T cell interacts with another cell that has seen, if you will, and bound a piece of a virus or a bacteria that's trying to infect the body. And that stimulates the T cell to divide and make more copies of the T cell that will then mount this large immune response for our body to fight the infection. B cells have multiple functions as well, but are most particularly associated with antibody production. So they make antibodies against viruses and against bacteria. Deficiency in T cells can cause something called agamma globulinemia, and that's when an individual is not able to produce sufficient amounts of antibodies. And that can lead to increased bacterial infection or viral infection. And mitochondria, of course, are really important in B cells too. We know, for example, that they are required for the survival of plasma B cells, which are the specific B cells that remember and make antibodies for us. And also, just like with the other cell types, there are subtypes of B cells that each have their own specific job. And switching between those different types of B cells and those different jobs is something that mitochondria are important for. Okay, so now I've told you that immune cells need their mitochondria to function correctly and that immune cells protect us from infection. So next, you might ask, if you have a problem with the functioning of your mitochondria, are you going to therefore be at risk of an immune deficiency or not as strong of an immune function as we should expect, and therefore increased risks of infection? I will also talk a little bit about what this means for an individual who has a primary mitochondrial disorder and has had a COVID infection, and then what our group of expert mitochondrial physicians recommend. So the answer to this question is that absolutely yes, we know in some circumstances that immune function is compromised in specific mitochondrial disorders. And if you'll think back to that slide where I was talking about what are mitochondrial disorders, I told you all that I was making the point about how we diagnose them for a couple of reasons. And one of them is that in the days when genetic testing was hard to do, we were relying on clinical and other tests to characterize every disorder. So in that circumstance, there were immune deficiencies, syndromes that were known by immunologists to create specific immune deficiencies, specifically cartilage hair hypoplasia and Omenn syndrome. And those were not thought of by physicians and generally aren't specifically thought of today as mitochondrial disorders, because what the main medical problem is that these patients have is T cell dysfunction for cartilage hair hypoplasia and a severe combined immune deficiency in Omenn syndrome. So deficiencies in both T and B cells. But since we've developed genetic testing and been able to link specific diseases to specific genes, what we found is those two syndromes are actually caused by genes that work inside the mitochondrion. And also, there are mitochondrial disorders that we know have well-characterized immune phenotypes or immune problems. So Pearson syndrome, which, as you know, is the result of a large mitochondrial DNA deletion, can cause something called pancytopenia, meaning low levels of all blood cell types. And all of the immune cells I just described to you are blood cell types. These patients, for that reason, are at increased risk of infection. Barth syndrome, as I mentioned, is known to cause neutropenia in many patients, and that, of course, puts them at higher risk of infection as well. And finally, fumarate hydratase deficiency has also been shown to put some patients at risk of having low levels of neutrophils and therefore increased levels of infection. But that begs the question, is it just these five disorders that I've pulled out and been able to show you, or is this a problem for mitochondrial diseases more broadly? Any of those 300 different genes, for example? And the answer is, we don't fully know. But I and folks I've worked with, as well as other groups across the world, have tried to ask this question. And the way we've asked the question in this case is something we call retrospective study. So working with Dr. Catherine Sims, who was a mitochondrial disorder physician here at MGH for many years, as well as Dr. Yolan Walter, who is a pediatric immunologist, who was at Mass General, but has subsequently moved on to Johns Hopkins in Florida, we looked at a large cohort that Dr. Sims had assembled of about 100 patients with mitochondrial disorders based on either their genetics or their biochemical testing. We had about 8 years of time for which most of these patients had been followed, and we asked whether or not they had increased rates of severe infections or recurrent infection. And looking at that large group of patients, what we saw was about 40 of them had either a serious or recurrent infection. So they either had an infection they needed IV antibiotics for or surgery for, or had multiple infections in a short span of time. When we broke it down by infection type, what we saw was that the majority were having primarily bacterial infections. There was a subset who had both bacterial infections and fungal infections, and another group who would have viral infections and would have bacterial infections, and a few who had all three types. Perhaps the most surprising finding in our study was that 13% of these patients at some point had something we called systemic immune response syndrome, or SIRS. What is that? So in prior decades, we would have called it sepsis or sepsis continuum. And more recently, the term used is something called SOFAS, S-O-F-A-S. And it is a clinically defined syndrome of a paradoxical response to infection, where the body isn't able to keep its blood pressure up or develops increased difficulty breathing or other medical problems that can be life-threatening in the setting of infection. As I mentioned, all of the different immune cells, however, have their specific jobs, if you will. So whenever we're wondering if somebody has a risk of increased infection, we want to know what type of infection they're having, because that might point us to the cause. It may be, if they are primarily having bacterial infections, for example, that it's a neutrophil problem. But when we looked at all of the different infection types that these patients were having, we didn't see a specific pattern. We saw viruses, as I mentioned, we saw bacteria, we saw fungal infections, and one parasitic infection. We saw a lot of the same infections that we would see in the population at large, such as Staph aureus or influenza. It's just that we seem to see it more often than we would expect in the general population. So it was interesting to us then, and important, I think, that when another group did the same thing with different patients, they had very similar findings. So this is a study from 2019 led by Peter McGuire and Mary Kay Koenig. Mary Kay Koenig is at University of Texas, Houston, and they looked at 26 of her clinically and genetically defined mitochondrial disorder patients and asked if they had had any of the following infection-related problems. And what they found, as you can see, was a pretty high incidence of various types of infection. So recurrent ear infections or otitis media was a relatively common problem, along with sinus infections and pneumonia, abscesses, which are infections that probably required surgery to treat, surprisingly high rate of fungal infection at 40%. And I think really remarkable is the fact that nearly 50% of their patients required IV antibiotics at some point, and almost all of them had a slower recovery than we would expect after an infection. A large proportion of their patients had likely for that reason had an immunologic evaluation. And finally, the third study I have to present you with regarding this question was actually focused on causes of mortality or death in mitochondrial disease patients. This is from a South Korean cohort with about 31, again, clinically and genetically defined patients. And they asked what was the most common cause of death in their cohort. And what they found was that sepsis, which is blood infection and the dysfunctional response to that blood infection, was the most common cause of death in their patients, followed by pneumonia. And I think this is very interesting because if you were to look up the CDC all-cause mortality list for 2017, the same year, what you would see is that the top five causes of death in Americans for that year did not include any infection. And you actually have to go down to number nine, the ninth most common cause of death, to find infection, and that was influenza, and then down to number 12 before you get to sepsis. That, of course, has changed. You know, more recently with COVID, COVID was the third most common cause of death in 2021 in the United States, according to the CDC, but it was the only infectious cause of death listed as in the top 10 most common causes of death. So how about COVID-19? So thus far, I think the best information we have about COVID-19 and primary mitochondrial disease is a study released by our colleagues in Europe. What they did was to work together across several different hospitals and institutions and identify patients with primary mitochondrial disease who had gotten COVID-19 and look to see what happened. Again, retrospective. So they identified 79 patients in 10 different countries. 32% of them were hospitalized due to their COVID infection. 61% recovered fully, but 35% did have lasting sequela of the infection afterwards. And 4%, unfortunately, did die. When they asked what could they look at to predict who might be at higher risk of being hospitalized with COVID, what they found was patients with primary mitochondrial disease who had known lung disease were at higher risk, 7.5 higher risk than fold risk, excuse me, for hospitalization compared to primary mitochondrial disease patients who did not have pre-existing lung disease. So with all of this data in mind, what do mitochondrial disorder doctors recommend? So the Mitochondrial Medicine Society here in the United States, which I am part of, though I was not a part of the publication that I'm citing here, recommends that immune function should be evaluated early in any mitochondrial disease patient who has recurrent or severe infections. And what are recurrent or severe infections? They define it as a complicated infection, so maybe something needing surgery, an infection occurring in at multiple locations in the body, or one that's resistant to treatment or caused by an unusual pathogen or organism, or something along the lines of 10 or more in upper respiratory tract infections a year. Excuse me. They also go on to say that immune testing may be useful to identify patients who might benefit from getting a medicine every day to prevent an infection, as opposed to waiting for an infection and treating it. Or interventions like immunoglobulin replacement therapy, or something called granulocyte colony stimulating factor, or GCSF. That's a protein our body makes naturally that promotes the growth of neutrophils. And in Barth syndrome, for example, where we know neutrophils are low, some patients will get GCSF as a medical treatment. So now we've looked and we've seen that immune cells need mitochondria, and that patients with mitochondrial disorders may have a higher risk of infection. So, of course, one of our most important tools in preventing infection is immunization. And you might ask, if the immune function is impaired, are patients' abilities to mount a successful immunization response impaired? And the question is possibly, I'm sorry, the answer to the question is possibly. So this is data from that same paper that Dr. Sims and Dr. Walter and I put together. Dr. Walter had immunophenotyped several of those patients, only 9 of them, so not nearly the majority. And what she had seen, as I've boxed here in red for you in this table, is that a few of these patients did have either low titers to specific vaccines or antibodies that didn't bind as strongly as she might have expected. Now, what do I mean by low titer? So when we get a vaccine, our B cells are stimulated to make antibodies to fight that specific infection. And weeks or months later, or even years later, your doctor can check your blood to see what the level of antibodies present to that specific virus that you've been vaccinated against are. And in the cases where we're indicating low here, it means that some of these patients had, or that particular patient had, less antibody protein levels than we would expect. I will emphasize that that is not the same as having had an infection. That wasn't what was reported. And it's not clear if the low titers mean that the patient would be more susceptible to infection or not, though that would be what we might be concerned about in that case. So again, the groups from the NIH and Texas asked the same question and looked actually at their 26 patients for vaccine titers for each of these different vaccines that are part of our routine immunization schedule. And interestingly, while things like polio and diphtheria seem to universally produce antibody levels that we would expect within normal range in their patients, what they found was in many cases, there were lower than expected antibody levels. So you'll see at the bottom here, the varicella or chickenpox vaccine, in 30% of cases or so, the patients had lower than expected levels of the antibody in their blood after a vaccine. Another study along these lines looked specifically at Lee syndrome French Canadian variant, a group in Canada, and they looked at the MMR vaccine, so measles, mumps, and rubella, and they tested the antibody levels in the blood of their patients to see if they had what we would expect as far as levels of antibodies against each one of these viruses. And as you can see, as indicated by the positive or negative signs here, some patients mounted the expected response for all 3 viruses, which is great. But in many patients, there was an appropriate response for one virus. You know, here we see for measles, the value is positive, but for mumps and for rubella, it's not within the expected range. So again, just like the pattern, or the lack of pattern, I should say, that we saw with the infection, they didn't see a clear pattern as far as when or if a patient would or would not mount what we would consider an appropriate level of antibody response to a vaccine. So next I'm gonna ask a very important question that I think is a frequent point of conversation, which is, are patients with primary mitochondrial disorders at a higher risk of adverse event from routine immunization or from COVID immunization? And then we'll talk about, what does the Mitochondrial Medicine Society recommend? And importantly, what do patients think? What have they experienced? So for this question, we have less data specific to mitochondrial diseases and more data with with the larger group of inborn errors of metabolism. So that's including disorders that might not classically be considered mitochondrial disease, but involve processes that happen in metabolism that happen in the mitochondria or otherwhere in other places in the cell. This group looked at the medical record system from Kaiser in Northern California, which is a large hospital system there. And they identified a little over 300 infants and children with inborn errors of metabolism and compared them to controls. And what they saw was that at 30 days after getting a vaccine, there was no increased risk of going to the emergency room or being hospitalized. When they did a secondary analysis, though, they did see that amongst the sickest or most severely affected patients, there might have been an increased rate of hospitalization 2 weeks following the immunization, though that did not reach significance and the reasons were unclear, particularly because there wasn't actually an increase in the number of emergency room visits 2 weeks after immunization. Another group asked the same question more recently in 2019, but what they did was rather than compare patients with inborn errors of metabolism to controls who did not have that diagnosis and probably had fewer reasons to go to the hospital or the emergency room anyway, what they did was to compare patients who had inborn errors of metabolism. Did they have more hospitalizations 30 days after getting a vaccine compared to 30 days before getting a vaccine? So they again looked retrospectively after the fact at their medical records, 43 children. And what they saw was that there was no difference in emergency room visits or hospitalizations when they compared the 30 days before a child got a vaccination and the 30 days after a child got a vaccination. So whenever we look at data, we have to think very carefully about what can this data tell us and what is this data actually not able to tell us. And I want to put forward some really important caveats here. All of these studies I've just presented to you were retrospective. And when we have a retrospective study, one that's conducted after the fact, there's always a big risk of introducing biases that will give us a wrong answer or obscure a correct one. And those include things like ascertainment bias. You might ask, for example, if you're only looking at hospital records, are you missing patients who might have mitochondrial disorders but didn't get sick and therefore never went to the hospital? There can be chronology biases. So I think it's very intuitive right now to think about how looking at medical records in 2020 would be a very different thing to looking at medical records in 2005. The only studies that I've presented here that used controls for comparison were the immunization studies. So neither the paper I published nor the either of the other two I presented to you before actually compared rates of infection to healthy controls. And all of these studies looked at multiple different disorders, so either mitochondrial disorders as a group or inborn errors of metabolism as a group. And I know this audience is very much aware that no two disorders are the same. So I want to emphasize that while this certainly makes me as a physician and an investigator much more vigilant about the risk of immune dysfunction and infection in patients, it will require a lot more work to know with certainty what the risks are and what the appropriate responses will be. And going back, of course, to what do we consider standard of care? What is best practice? So the Mitochondrial Medicine Society says that patients with primary mitochondrial disorders should be offered age-appropriate vaccines. And they include the flu vaccine in that. And potentially, they may need additional vaccines, particularly if they have underlying lung disease. In 2020, the Mitochondrial Medicine Society put out a very specific recommendation regarding the COVID-19 vaccine. At that time, of course, we had not had the opportunity to perform any studies regarding efficacy or safety, specifically in patients with primary mitochondrial disorders. But as a group, it was felt that the risks associated with COVID-19 infection were far worse than the potential risks of a vaccine, and the recommendation was made to consider vaccination for our patients with primary mitochondrial disorders. Now, finally, I really love this study that Dr. Gordon Lipkin and Dr. McGuire's group put out. They asked, they surveyed families with patients with primary mitochondrial disorders and asked them if they agreed with each of these statements. On the left, you see the first statement: the benefits of the following vaccines outweigh the risks of children with mitochondrial disease. And these first seven are routine immunizations, including flu shots. And what you can see in blue are the individuals who agreed with that statement, and over 60% of parents and families agreed with the statement that each of these vaccines probably gave us greater benefits than risks. When that was asked about the COVID-19 vaccine specifically, the percentage was a little lower, reflecting, I'm sure, how new this vaccine is, and the experience with it is, of course, much smaller than with these other vaccines. The second statement they put forward was, I am concerned that my child with mitochondrial disease will become sick or deteriorate after the following vaccinations. And what you can see, again, in blue are the individuals who agreed with that statement. And it's a pretty small percentage, 20% or less, for each of these routine immunizations. And again, a little bit higher, the COVID-19 vaccination. So in summary, mitochondria are intracellular organelles with multiple function, the disruption of which can produce multi-system primary mitochondrial disorders. Immune cells are specialized cells that move throughout our bodies to fight infection in cell type specific manner, and they require mitochondrial function. And in patients with primary mitochondrial disorders, there may be an increased risk of infection or immune deficiency. If a patient with primary mitochondrial dysfunction has COVID-19 infection, they are at higher risk of needing to go to the hospital if they had pre-existing lung disease. Patients with primary mitochondrial disorders should be seen by an immunologist if they have recurrent or severe infections, and they may have differences in their ability to make antibodies after getting a vaccine. However, they are likely not to have side effects that require emergency room or hospital care 30 days after immunization. And in general, it is likely that the benefits of vaccination outweigh the risks, both for routine immunization and COVID immunization in patients with primary mitochondrial disorder. And with that, I will wrap up and end and take questions. But first, I'll acknowledge the amazing people I get to work with here at MGH, specifically Dr. Melkara in the Mitochondrial Disorders Clinic and Dr. Mutha in the research aspects. So thank you all very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's been absolutely very informative, and I've learned a lot about the immune system, which is so important. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time to kind of walk us through from the very beginning and then kind of diving a little bit deeper in. We've had a lot of questions filter through. One of the questions that I think that you may have answered, but I just kind of want to rehash it. How do you test to see, you know, you talked about the neutrophils, the eosinophils, the NK cells. Is there a way to specifically test to see if certain ones are being affected, or is that something that you kind of do correlationally, like depending on what's going on?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is both. So that idea of patterns of infection, and this is really the job of our amazing colleagues in immunology, but they will get a history and they will see, oh, these specific types of infections seem to be happening more often. I might want to send this test or that test to either look at the number of specific cell types present, or there are some tests we can do to actually test the function of these cells, even just in the hospital clinically.
Okay, now that's really helpful. Are you finding many mito patients with hypogammaglobulinemia? Or CVID?
So Severe combined immune deficiency, I have not personally seen a lot of, and I think that's for the simple reason that when a patient has such a severe immune phenotype, they typically present to immunologists. And as I mentioned, with those diseases I listed, those are historically thought of as immune deficiencies, not mitochondrial diseases, even though those two specific ones are caused by mitochondrial genes. As far as the low levels or a gamma globulinemia, we have seen that in patients. And I can't give you a great number on it. I don't have a scientific number to give, but this is why the Mitochondrial Medicine Society does make the recommendation that patients with severe or recurrent infections be seen by an immunologist who can then do some tests to see if something like that is present and if any interventions might be helpful.
So this kind of coincides with that question a little bit. So let's say you start off at an immunologist office, right? And you haven't been diagnosed with mito yet. How often do immunologists need to screen for mitochondrial disorders in their immune deficient patients?
Oh, that's a great question. I imagine that varies very much center to center. Many panels that would be sent for genetic testing for genetic immune deficiencies most of them will include those disorders that I mentioned specifically, where it's very well known. I imagine that it would be unusual for someone to have a exclusively immune phenotype that is then sent on to a mitochondrial disorders doctor. Often, as you all know, and as we were talking about, there are multiple systems involved. So it's typically, you would think of it more in the setting of somebody who might have many other symptoms and also have these recurrent infections.
Okay. A patient asked, she said, I had GBS response to a vaccine. I then found out that I had evidence of reactivated long-term EBV, Epstein-Barr. Is reactivated EBV common with mito, and should this be addressed with my medical provider?
So I definitely think any medical concerns you have, bring it up to your doctor. I can say as a doctor, I always want somebody to ask me the question rather than not. And then as far as reactivated EBV and mitochondrial disorders, that's a great question. And I don't know that it's ever been asked and by doctors or scientists and studied in a way that there's an answer. I haven't looked to see that question specifically, but it is not to my knowledge something that's been asked. I know that it is something that the actually multiple sclerosis doctors have recently been paying a lot of attention to, because it does seem like EBV infection at certain stages of life could predispose you to multiple sclerosis, which is, of course, something very separate and not a genetic condition.
Another patient asked, I have been tested for immunity to MMR and all three were negative. I've had four shots now. What does that mean for me as a 67-year-old mito patient? Are there any tests that they can run to check other vaccines?
Oh, that's a great question. And I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis. I can't give specific medical advice, unfortunately, over Zoom. But I would definitely encourage you to talk to your mito doc and to your immunologist if you have one. And if you don't have one, I would get one. I think those are great questions to address with them.
Can they check titers for other vaccines other than MMR for the patient, possibly?
So there are definitely other clinical tests available. Whether that's the right thing to do or not, you'd have to talk specifically to your doctor about.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Is there any research showing that taking vitamin K2-MK7 helps repair cells?
Not to my knowledge, but again, I haven't specifically looked with that question in mind for research studies, but nothing pops into my head at this moment.
What are you recommending for immune function screening, or does that depend on the gene? For example, T cell, B cell, subset, cytokine panel, et cetera.
So I think it's very gene specific, very patient specific. So for example, those five disorders that I listed, I would absolutely, in a patient who had Barth syndrome, for example, make sure that they had their neutrophil levels tested. and get them in with an immunologist early. As far as the other genes and disorders, it comes down to clinical phenotype and presentation. So as just like the Mitochondrial Medicine Society says, if somebody has severe infections or recurrent infections, in all honesty, what I'm doing is sending them to one of my amazing colleagues in allergy and immunology and having them do a full evaluation according to their history and exam.
So this kind of goes back to a little bit about the Guillain-Barré conversation that we had earlier. Do you know if there is any evidence right now that there's an increased risk for mito patients getting Guillain-Barré from vaccines? Has there been any research done on that?
Not to my knowledge. So we know that Guillain-Barré syndrome is a risk with some immunizations in particular, and it is something that has been reported as an adverse event in with COVID immunization. The only studies that I'm aware of to date regarding vaccine safety in patients with primary mitochondrial disorders are the ones I showed today. And they looked at hospitalization and emergency room visits. I would intuit that that would include patients who might have had Guillain-Barré syndrome, because certainly if you have Guillain-Barré syndromes, your symptoms are probably severe enough that you're seeking medical care in that setting. However, they do not specifically say that they did or didn't look for that. And to my knowledge, no one has rigorously studied that.
So it might be helpful for patients to talk to their doctors if there are specific vaccines that are at a greater risk for Guillain-Barré than others.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, that's an individualized discussion based mm-hmm. on your medical history, your symptoms, and your risk of being exposed to a certain disease, mm-hmm. as well as your risk of developing side effects.
I know we talked a little bit about this yesterday, Melissa. They're asking about mast cell disorder. Are you finding
yes.
mito patients who also have mast cell disorder? And do you think that they are more at risk for infections?
You know, I personally have not seen that specific syndrome in the setting of primary mitochondrial disorders, but that's my personal experience. I am not aware of any studies specifically asking that question. I know that we think a lot about mitochondrial dysfunction in mast cell related diseases. And I am simply not expert enough to say much of great value or intelligence on that point. But certainly, you know, as I showed, we know that all of these cells use their mitochondria in their function. So it is not a real stretch to think that there might be some level of mitochondrial dysfunction involved.
Absolutely. All right, one last question. This patient's asking if you know of any good resources for mito patients with identified immune deficiency in terms of guidelines for management. Are there,
So I would point you to the Mitochondrial Medicine Society guidelines that I mentioned. And if you Google Mitochondrial Medicine Society, you'll come up with the webpage, which makes those guidelines freely available as a PDF. And there's great mito one-on-one resources available on that website as well that you can share, that you can read yourself and share with your physicians. Those would be, I think, to date, the best resources. And for those who are interested in research studies, I will say Peter McGuire at the NIH is working very actively in the space. And looking on clinicaltrials.gov for some of his work might be a great thing to do.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Dr. Walker. We really, really appreciate all of your hard work in this area, your interest in this area, and just being here today and helping us to better understand how immunology works with mitochondrial disease. And we're excited to see the future research that you do in this area too, because I think it's absolutely something that our patients can see all the hearts and the thumbs up that are going out, you know.
Just very kind.
we really appreciate everything that you do for our community. So And thank you.
Thank
I
you
also want
all.
to thank you to all of our patients and our families and our Mito community that's joined us today, clinicians on the call. You've asked amazing questions here, and I love that we can all learn together. I hope that you'll consider joining us next month with Dr. Alessandra Pregone, who'll discuss modeling mitochondrial diseases with patient-derived stem cells and brain organoids. So until next time, stay well, and we will see you soon.
Care. Thank you again so much for the invitation.